I apologize, I don't have a mic, so that our presenters will have mics. My name is Bree Fisher, and I'd like to welcome you to the Women on Wednesday series, Still Fighting for Our Rights 30 Years Later. Two housekeeping items before we get started. Please turn off all your cell phones and pagers, and please stay in your seats until 12:50. Also, if you could please fill out the evaluation sheets, as we do use this for future programming. Women of color, identified as minority women, in the 1977 National Plan of Action, gave voice to the racism of the women's movement and the visible double discrimination experienced by women of color, based on issues of race and gender. The plan outlines the numerous areas of impact on the lives of women of color, namely employment, education, reproductive rights, immigration, and health, among others. Our panelists will offer perspectives and information about the realities, progress, and unmet agendas for women of color in the U.S. Sharon Finde is Interim Student Services Coordinator at the SESU American Indian Center. She is an enrolled member of the Fort Peck Assiniboine and Sioux Tribes of Montana, and a descendant of a Little Traverse Band of Ottawa Indians from Michigan. Finde is completing her master's degree in educational leadership from North Dakota State University. She was employed at Concordia College in Moorhead, Minnesota as the Director of American Indian Recruiting and Programming for 4 years. Deborah Lee is a professor in the Department of Theater, Film Studies, and Dance at SESU. She is also the principal investigator of the grant that established the SESU Community Anti-Racism Education, or CARE Team. As the coordinator, Lee teaches anti-racism workshops for faculty, staff, students, and community members, and serves in consultative role on issues of racism at SESU. She holds a BA from the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and MFA from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. And hopefully, Dr. Margaret Villanueva will be joining us shortly. She teaches racial issues and community development courses in the Department of Community Studies at SESU. She received a doctorate in sociology and an MA in history from the University of California, Santa Cruz. And her current teaching and research focuses on Latina and Latino communities in the Midwest, in addition to the local CARE team. We are very grateful to have them here today. Please join the Women's Center in welcoming Sharon Finde, Deborah Lee, and hopefully Dr. Margaret Villanueva. Thank you.
Well, I guess I'll start. I want to start by saying that in 1988, there was an African-American woman on the ticket for presidential nomination for the Democratic Party. Anybody know who that was? Wow. Shirley Chisholm was on the Democratic Party in 1988. So before even Jesse Jackson ran for president, or before Al Sharpton ran for president, there was an African-American woman who ran for president. And there have been so many incredible African-American women who have been involved in all kinds of things. People like Ida B. Wells, Judith Jamison, Ella Baker, Angela Bassett, Sojourner Truth, Marian Anderson, Carol Brahms Mosley, Daisy Bates, Toni Morrison, and the list goes on to include people like Oprah Winfrey, Aretha Franklin, Diana Ross, etc. And so often these names go by and people have no idea who these women are or what they did. And that's one of the things that's really interesting about the African-American women in this country is the invisibility that they face, even today. It's still there. In terms of education, though, African-American women seem to be doing pretty well. African-American women figure out pretty early on that education is central. We know that there are no shortcuts to success, and it's the single most important vehicle for upward mobility, stability, and viability. And we're socialized in such a way that we're encouraged and supported through our college education. And what I mean by that is that we're socialized from a time that we're very young, that you need to go to college, that you need your college education. And when we get in college, we have families that support us, and also within the university support systems that help us to complete our college education. And it goes beyond just a first degree. Very often African American women are getting advanced degrees. 64% of all African American students enrolled in colleges are African American women. In fact, there are 5 females for every 1 male that graduates from college. Upon completion of our college degrees, we find that our college degree is one of our greatest assets. The degree creates economic opportunities, and when employers see them, immediately they are a stamp of approval. As a result, there's been a dramatic growth in the number of black women in business. The number of businesses owned by black women jumped from 75% in the last year as compared to 29% for men. Of the $850 billion of spending power in the African American community today, African American women control 62% of that. One of the direct consequences, and we have to kind of talk about the consequences of being educated and being women, especially in terms of being black women, is that 45% of African American women never marry. This statistic is double the number of white women, 22%, who never marry. And there are many things that account for this. Often African-American men are intimidated by African-American women and their college degrees. African-American women are thought to be too independent. African-American men are dating women of other ethnicities. And an African-American couple may actually date for 14 years, have kids together, raise a family together, finally decide to get married, and within 3 years, they divorce. Another reality is that 70% of African-American children are born to single women, grown women, not teen mothers, but grown women who are choosing to have children without being married. Another 47% of African-American women are single, and they choose to adopt children. So then you start to think, well, maybe African American women don't really need men. When African American women are educated and gainfully employed, and we can adopt children if we want to parent, or we can choose a mate and have children without ever being married. So that question about, well, do we really need a man? It's always in the back of the mind. More than ever before, African-American women are dating and marrying white men. In the 2000 census, 95,000 African-American women were married to white men. In 2006, the number rose to 117,000 interracial couples. Although African-American women do overwhelmingly seek out relationships with African-American men, but the numbers are changing. And it used to be that interracial couples consisted of mostly black men dating white women. In an online survey by Essence.com, 81% said they approve of African-American women in interracial relationships. Today, black women are in environments that they've never been in before. Their education has kind of put them in business situations. They're traveling more, working in and out of the home, but they're in different environments than they have had access to in the past. And so their social circles have grown, and they have a much greater variety in terms of the people that they're meeting and where they're able to meet people. Also, they have access to internet dating blogs like Date a White Guy, or White Men Who Prefer Black Women, or dating websites like interracialmatch.com. So the bottom line is African American get tired of waiting for black men and feel they don't have as many options. The last place they want to meet men are in nightclubs. As African American women get older, they're less willing to compromise in relationships because they don't want to give up their lives or give up themselves in order to be married. At the same time, some women feel success is nothing without having someone to share it with. So it's not that marriage is not important, but it's like the thinking about it is a lot different than what it has been in the past. The fact remains that children still thrive in situations where they have two-parent families and loving two-parent families. The studies say that African-American children that don't have this foundation are easily attracted by street gangs. However, the fact is that African-American women have been raising African-American families for a very long time on their own, and they're really very good at it. You'll find that African-American mothers, even if they have to leave their children for a while, will go back and get them at some point. They will go back to school. They will pick up an extra job. They will move to a better community if they need to, so that their children have the opportunities that they need for success. And one of the things that African-American mothers teach their children, that the future is ripe and that opportunities are unlimited for them. I want to talk a little bit about health and African-American women. In terms of the state of African-American women and health, African-American women have more disease, disability, and early death than white women. Major health problems for African-American women include cancer, vision loss, tuberculosis, AIDS, and other STDs. The major cause of death for African-American women are heart disease, cancer, stroke, diabetes, and kidney disease. African-American women are about twice as likely to have diabetes as white women of the same age, and they're more likely to have other serious health problems caused by diabetes. Among women, about 2 out of every 3 new HIV cases are African-American women, and high rates of other STDs includes chlamydia, gonorrhea, syphilis as well. African-American women are less likely to receive health care, and then when they do receive the care, they are more likely to receive it late. For example, African-American mothers are twice as likely to have late or no parental prenatal care compared to white mothers, according to the studies in 2004. In some studies, African-American women are less likely to get breast cancer than white women, but when they do get breast cancer, they get it at a much younger age, and the cancer is much more aggressive and deadly. Doctors realized that most of the information gathered about breast cancer was gathered solely from white women, and the genetic differences between white women and African-American women suggest the disease may be a completely different disease in black women, requiring a different kind of treatment. The American Cancer Society finds that while breast cancer death rates are decreasing for white women, for African-American women, death rates are either flat or rising. Death rates are 36% higher among African-American women. The timeliness of treatment, again, is a major factor in underserved communities. More African-American women are needed to participate in clinical units, or clinical trials. And these trials are not experimentations, but they're actually trials that help doctor together information and offer more opportunities for early intervention for African American women. There are other possible reasons for the differences in health statistics, including racism, poverty, cultural differences, lack of knowledge about the importance of screening or testing, to prevent health problems, and the inability of doctors or the lack of trust in the medical system. And I want to just touch a little bit more on racism and as it exists as a health problem for African American women. The studies find that the stress of racism, especially in employment, is one of those things that there hasn't been enough study on. And the studies that they do have talk about how the arteries harden and close as a result of stress, and that being one of the leading causes of the heart problems and strokes that African American women suffer from. And they link that directly to racism and racism in the workplace. Now, I mentioned earlier that a lot of African American women are starting their own businesses. And one of the reasons that they start their own businesses is to remove themselves from stressful situations in the workplace that cause health problems. And they find when they're working for themselves, they do a lot better. And they're finding success in doing that. I'm going to stop there for now and let one of the others go.
Thank you, Deborah. I'm extremely glad I let you go first because of all the information that you shared. And I was just sitting here almost laughing to myself because of the, to me, the amazing similarities between the population you're giving us information about in comparison to the American Indian culture. There are a lot of striking similarities. One of the things I wanted to just mention briefly, during the introduction, when I introduce myself, and not necessarily always in a place like this, but for example, for more cultural events, there might be a write-up that you'll be asked for your biography, and mine would say, in a different setting than this, mine would say Sharon Eagleman Finday is the daughter of Chet and Ruth Eagleman of Lawrence, Kansas. She's the, or her maternal grandparents are, and then they would say where they're from, and then paternal grandparents. And so with that comes my tribal affiliation. So in my introduction, it said that I'm an enrolled member of the Fort Peck, Assiniboine, and Sioux tribes of Montana. And then it also said that I was a descendant of the Little Traverse Bay Band of Ottawa Indians from the state of Michigan. What that means, I'm not sure if any of you are familiar with blood quantum or anything, but what that means is that my dad is a full blood from Fort Peck. And so therefore I'm half of his tribe, and then my mother's a full blood Ottawa from the state of Michigan, so I'm half of her tribe also. But I have an older brother and a sister, and my parents chose to enroll us in my dad's tribe. So on my tribal enrollment paper, it says that I'm 4/4 American Indian, but they're only counting half. So it says that I'm half or one half, whatever, blood quantum from Fort Peck. And like I said, if we were in a different setting, that's something that I always mention because that's, I guess that's just how I think of myself first. I was laughing up here because I just wanted you all to know that, in my opinion, I was laughing when Deborah was talking about African American men being intimidated by women, who are independent and who have their education. And the same thing goes for American Indian men. I just want you to know that. No, I'm just kidding. But anyway, there are some different things that I wanted to touch on, but I wanted to give you a little bit of my background, a little bit more of my background, because I think that it applies to the situations that I'm encountering as I'm older. My mom and dad chose to raise us in my mother's hometown of Grand Rapids, Michigan. So we went to the same Catholic grade school and high school my mother went to, that she and her brothers and sisters went to. And we were always the only American Indian family at our grade school and in our and then at our high school. The only other American Indian students were my first cousins on my mother's side. So, very close relatives. And there were usually maybe five of us together at one time, and then someone would move up. And so the reason I'm sharing that is because I feel fortunate that I received the education I did in grade school and in high school. And I know I had a lot more, I had more opportunity than several of my American Indian friends who grew up out here, you know, North Dakota and Montana. And I played sports, and I'm the youngest of three. I was sick when I was younger, so I'm kind of spoiled. And so my parents let me get, you know, my family let me get away with that. And so I was always more assertive. And so I was never afraid to speak up and speak my mind, as opposed to a lot of my best friends now who are American Indian women. And my parents both had really good jobs. My dad worked for the state of Michigan. My mother worked for General Motors. Those were the top two with benefits, health-wise, you know, health benefits. Those were the top two places in the state of Michigan. So we always had really really good health care. And that leads into this first part I wanted to tell you about. I used to work at Concordia College in Moorhead, and I served as the director of American Indian Recruiting and Programming. And when my son was born 2 years ago, he was in the NICU. He was in the intensive care unit that the day he was born for a couple of days. So when I got the bill, it was several thousand dollars more than what I had expected and what my insurance at Concordia did not cover. And when I first graduated from college, the first job I took was determining eligibility for food stamps and Medicaid on the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation for Sioux County Social Services. And I cannot believe that I forgot that I could apply for Medicaid. You know, I was just thinking that my income might be too high. But what happens is, as a pregnant woman, you're eligible no matter what. I forgot about that, that no matter what your income is, you're eligible. And my son was going to be eligible because from birth to age two, he would be eligible. So what happened when I did apply for that, after a certain time period, I was not eligible myself because of my income, but my son was. So for 2 years, he had Blue Cross Blue Shield primary care insurance, health care insurance, and Medicaid was secondary. And the reason I bring this up is because I don't know, to be honest with you, I don't know if it was really my pride or my ego, but, you know, in all of these visits that we went to, you know, there's a lot, you know, when they're first born. And whenever the women at the receptionist desk at Merit Care in Fargo or anywhere I went for anything with him, as soon as they would find out that we were on Medicaid, it seemed like their attitude really changed towards me. And then when I would go to the social services, and I used to have that job, and I know that they do not require a 4-year degree to have a job like that. So you could either have a 2-year degree or certain years of experience. And I felt like the people I worked or the caseworkers I was assigned to were more concerned about telling me what all I wasn't eligible for, as opposed to trying to help me find different ways to get different things covered. And so I got to thinking, you know, I'm glad that, I guess I should just be grateful that I didn't grow up having that experience, you know, being treated a certain way just because of the healthcare coverage that you were eligible for at that time. And so that kind of opened my eyes to different things, and it made me wonder about the services that people do, you know, or I guess the customer service that different women have to put up with and who aren't assertive enough to address that or don't feel that they know where to go or you know, like what policies they can read or what all their rights are. I guess I mentioned that. The other thing is, when my son was born, when he was in the intensive care, my husband's family lived 2 hours away. They were from the Leech Lake, or they are from the Leech Lake Ojibwe Reservation, and they all came down. There were about, I don't know, about 12 or 14 of his family, and then like 4 or 5 from mine. And the nurses, it was kind of a cultural thing. I could hear them. We were up in the NICU, and this lady was on the phone, and she said, "What? What?" And I could hear the lady down the hall saying, "There are about 20 people down here, and they all want to see this baby. What am I supposed to do?" You know, and it just made me feel like they felt like a gang showed up or something, you know. And I kind of felt, I don't know how to say how I felt, but I was irritated, and I felt like, well, this is his family. This is my family. These are my in-laws. They want to be here, especially because he's in the NICU now. And so we had to send them down two at a time. And they just made me feel uncomfortable, you know, with their attitude. And just my, you know, my whole experience there was not, you know, that great, you know, when my son was born. But that's a whole nother story. The other thing that I wanted to touch on with education-wise is, you know, with American Indian women, it's similar to what Deborah was talking about, how more are graduating with 4-year degrees and then furthering their education on to a master's and PhD, you know, level programs. And the reason I think that's important is because in all areas, American Indian studies or social work or anything, I always think it's important for us to be teaching about us. You know, American Indians to be teaching about us and about the different challenges that we face and the different needs that we might have. And it goes the same thing, like for admissions here. You know, it's important for an American Indian person to be giving input, because you can't recruit students of color the same way you recruit white students. I mean, that's my own personal opinion. But so that's what I mean, why it's important for us to get our education and to be in these positions where we can be of, you know, of most help or most useful, I guess, to American Indians. That's how I look at my job, is I try to figure out how can I be of best service to my community. And that doesn't mean my community from Fort Peck or from Michigan. It means the American Indian community in general. This is the other personal thing I wanted to share before I turn it over. But there have been times when I worked at Concordia College, and we did work with, it was called Training Our Campuses Against Racism, and there were all different types of anti-racism training that we received, and there were faculty and staff who were very interested and who wanted to learn more about this type of work, and that's all good and fine, but I just wonder how students feel sometimes, students of color, when they sit in a classroom and they listen to a faculty or they listen to their instructor make comments that are really clueless and they may have certain stereotypes. And because that happened to me at Concordia, and I'm the kind of person who, when I hear something, I can't think fast enough. I get so, I don't know what it is. I don't know if it's annoyed or irritated or so disappointed that this person who has a PhD is making a statement like this. For example, we were sitting faculty staff orientation or it was like the first 2 days of school, and I was split up into this discussion group, and there was this man who taught history, and he was saying, whatever happened to that service learning trip to New Mexico, you know? Didn't they go to some Hopi reservation or something? Because, you know, my daughter-in-law is married to a full-blood Hopian. I still don't know what to think about that. And, you know, I got to learn more about this, you know. And I was thinking, oh, my goodness, you know, my dad, I can't imagine my dad ever making a comment like that in front of a group of people, colleagues or students or staff or anybody, saying, you know, my daughter Sharon, she married a white guy, and I still don't know what to do about that. You know, I got to learn more about you guys. You know, so tell me, you know, like, speak for your people. You know, like, tell me all about you. You know, I can't imagine him making a comment like that. And I was so, you know, flabbergasted. I don't know what the word is to say that. I couldn't even think of anything, but I was really offended. So there's that. And there's two other things I want to mention. I'm sorry, real quick. With this anti-racism training, to me, it's all interesting. It was really interesting for me to learn about white privilege. But what I've been thinking about this last year or two is it's always about people of color helping white people understand these stereotypes and dismantling stereotypes and all coming to the table and all this and that. But how long is that going to take? And I wonder, could we ever look at it from a different angle where we could teach or not teach, but we could have discussions and work with people of color out there in the field on how to, and I don't want to say play the game, but it's like, how do you move on from here, as opposed to waiting to educate all of these white people who are so willing and you know, eager to learn? So that's the one thing I wanted to mention. The other thing is that what I found is people who are not of color, they may have the best intentions, and they think that, like, in my mind, I always say these people think they're real down. You know, they just think they're down with the cause, and they know everything. But yet, people close to me have said things to me, and it's because I'm American Indian and because I'm a woman, they'll make statements to me that, to me, are hurtful, because I think, well, number one, you're my friend, and you know me and my family. You've known us for years. Don't you think you should know better by now? And plus, you've been doing this social justice work and anti-racism training for this long, and then you can still make a comment like that. And what I mean by that is, for example, I have a friend who thinks that because I'm American Indian and because I'm a woman, that I can get into any PhD program I choose. You know, my bachelor's is in psychology from Montana State University, Billings, and I will be honest, I hate to admit something like this in front of a large group of students like this, but I will. You know, I really didn't apply myself as well as I should have in undergrad, and that really came back to haunt me when I was applying for some PhD programs. And there were a handful of schools, there were five, that did have two slots reserved specifically for an American Indian student in a clinical psychology doctoral program. And I applied, I think, to two different schools, and I wasn't accepted, but I wasn't surprised, you know what I mean? Because my grade point average wasn't, you know, 4.0, and my GRE scores were, you know, they were all right. But my friend was just so dead set on, well, you know, Sharon, I just don't see how many other American Indians out there trying to get their degrees in psychology. You know, you should, you know, you'll be able to get in, you know? And I was thinking, well, obviously there's a lot more than me because I'm not getting in. I'm not getting accepted. You know, there are a lot more out there with better GPAs and better GRE scores, more research experience than me. But those are things, and maybe I should have a tougher skin, a thicker skin, but things like that to me are more hurtful because it's coming from someone who thinks that they know, who considers them an advocate for people of color. So I think that's all I wanted to, share right now.
Okay, hello. I'm Margaret Villanueva. I'm a professor in the Department of Community Studies, and I apologize for being late. I'm also on the CARE team with Deborah. So I want to talk a little bit about the progress of, I guess, since the 1970s among Latinas. And I know in the early 70s, I was a student at a community college in California, and it was difficult at that time to find books about women in general, no less about Latinas. And I took one class on Chicano, it was kind of improvised class by a professor who almost volunteered to do this extra class on Chicano literature, meaning Mexican-American literature. And one of the books we used, because there were very few books at that time, there were very few novels. I mean, the old ones hadn't been republished. They weren't available for enough for a whole class and so forth. And there's been a huge boom. I mean, there has been such a boom in authors, writing, artists among Latinas. And that's, you know, part of the good news in the progress of Latinas that I want to mention. So one of the books we did have available back then in that little community college class was called A Chapbook by a group of poets in San Jose, and that was headed up by a woman by the name of Lorna D. Cervantes. Now she is a nationally known Chicano poet. She has a doctorate, and some of the other well-known Latina writers also come from the Midwest, actually. So we have Sandra Cisneros from Chicago, Anna Castillo from Chicago, and maybe some of you have read, especially Sandra Cisneros' book, House on Mango Street, which is used in a lot of college classes. So that one area that where the good news is in the progress in women, Latina women getting involved in the arts. And by Latina, what I mean is people and women of Latin American descent. And when I say Chicana, I mean women, Mexican-American women who identify themselves as Chicana, which usually also implies that they support the Chicano political movement for social justice that started in the 60s and is ongoing. And then another word that's used often is Hispanic, that you've probably heard. And Hispanic was a word coined by the federal government in the 1970s, and is used often in business and also in government publications, though Latino is being used more often these days. So I usually use the word Latino or Chicano if I'm talking specifically about people identify themselves as Chicanas. So aside from some of the famous Chicana writers, there are also the artists such as Judith Baca. She headed up a huge mural project for young people in Los Angeles, a half-mile-long mural in the Los Angeles River cement walls. There's the Chicana writers Laura Esquivel, Pat Mora, Denise Chavez, and many others. There's Chilean writer Isabel Allende, internationally known, Dominican writer Julia Alvarez, Cuban writer, Cristina Garcia, Salvadorian, Sandra Benitez, and Puerto Rican writers, Rosario Ferre and Esmeralda Santiago, and they're just a few of the very, very many, many Latina poets and writers who emerged, especially in the 1980s and the 1990s, prize-winning authors. Also in the area of scholarship, you know, there in the 70s, there was, you know, in California, I knew a lot of young women going to college, like myself, just starting out in community college. One of the things that in the Latino communities and, is that a lot of emphasis on helping communities, helping families, helping each other, which is both a positive and sometimes a negative, because to talk a little bit about progress in the way that Deborah talked about progress in this terms of education, income, many times Latino students leave school early, especially in the immigrant generation or first generation born in the United States, because they want to help out their families. So that among males, Latinos have between the age of 16 and about 23, 24 have the highest income of youth in that group across the country. But of course that diminishes right away after the age 23, 24 because you have these young people working in full-time jobs but in relatively like manual service industry, factories and construction and jobs like that, so that as others graduate from school and their incomes start going up, the percentage or the comparative level of Latino families and incomes stays steady or goes down because education achievement isn't high enough. So to talk a couple more good news since the 1970s for Latinas. Like black women, Latinas are very involved in small businesses and entrepreneurships. Actually, Latinas, Latinas are the fastest growing small business owners in the United States. Latinos in general own more firms than other ethnic minorities. 39% of minority firms are Latinos. And out of those, 28% of the Latino firms are owned by women, by Latino women. So I think, again, the importance of family to Latinas is interrelated to wanting to go into business, not just what Deborah talked about as far as getting away from a workplace where you have a low-level job or there's racism and discrimination going on, but also being able to be in a job where maybe your kids could be there starting a small business and being close to home, maybe even having your children right there with you or nearby is important to a lot of women, and therefore that's another reason that I found talking to women entrepreneurs why they want to go into small businesses rather than working a kind of a 9-to-5 or swing shift job and being away from their kids. The other area, of course, is in politics and leadership. For Latinas, getting involved in politics has to do, again, with supporting the community, moving not individually ahead so much as moving communities ahead, working on community organizing, improvements for education, and so forth. However, in politics itself, more and more Latinas are involved in actual electoral politics. So Latinas in 2001 constituted 38%, or almost 2,000 out of all Latino elected positions in the country. So we're getting up towards, you know, almost half of elected officials among Latinos are women. And here in Minnesota, you might know. I believe she came here and talked last semester. Patricia Torres Rey is a state senator elected in 2006 from Minnesota to the Minnesota State Senate. However, on the more downside, on educational achievement, the high school graduation rates for Latinas is pretty much the lowest of all groups by gender and ethnicity and race in the country. Latinas are also less likely to take SAT exams. And when they do, they score lower. They also are under-enrolled in gifted and talented courses. They have a lower level of receiving bachelor's degrees. In Minnesota, about 46% of Latinos graduate from high school, based on a report from 2002. That's compared to, of course, much higher levels, about 80% of white students graduating. In the socioeconomic sense, I guess everyone knows, being here on Women on Wednesday, talks that women only earn 76 cents to every dollar that men earn. But among Latinas, they only earn 58 cents to every dollar earned by men. That's men in general. So the Latina, if you look by race, gender, ethnicity, across the board, Latinas have the lowest earnings of all groups in the country. As far as the households and the families that Latinos live in, their income is also much lower. The white median income is about $48,000 on the national level, and for Hispanic households, it's $34,000 a year on the national level. The poverty rate also for Latino households is higher, approximately 21%, or almost 23% of Latino households are in poverty, compared to between 8 and 9% for white families. So even though on some hands there's been a lot of progress, women getting into business, women being leaders, women supporting their communities, on the other hand, you also have a concentration of Latina women in jobs that don't pay as well, partly because of the problem of education, of not graduating from high school. One of the things many young women are doing here in Minnesota, immigrant women and supporters of immigrant women are trying to get something passed called a DREAM Act. About 11 or 12 states in the countries allow not undocumented immigrants, children who have gone through K through 12 system in the state and graduate from high schools, to be able to go to a college like this one, a state college, with a normal state resident rate. And Minnesota has been trying for the past several years to pass a similar law, but Governor Pawlenty has decided, my own opinion is, because he would like to be the vice president nominee and wants to be very strictly conservative, he's clamped down really hard on immigrants in the state, even though they make up and they contribute very much economically to the state in the jobs they do, in the leadership, and so forth. But because of that, we haven't been able to pass this DREAM Act and enable these kids who graduate from high school to be able to go to our state-funded colleges. And so that's a current problem that we're having right here in Minnesota that affects the economic and educational opportunities for Latinas. Okay. I guess I'll end now so we can ask any of us questions about anything we've said.
Great question. It just so happens that it's tomorrow.
Can you repeat the question?
Yes. When is the next CARE workshop, and how can I register? The CARE workshop, Community Anti-Racism Education Initiative, does a workshop on understanding racism and anti-racism organizing. The next one is tomorrow. It's being sponsored by the Huskies Leadership Series, and it is specifically geared towards students, for students. It's free, it's open, we have snacks and beverages. It will be in the evening from 5 to 9 p.m. It's in this building. I believe it's in the Voyager Room or the Glacier Room, one of those two rooms upstairs. But you can check the at the information desk, and they can let you know for sure when it is or where it is. For sure it's tomorrow. I also just want to add one thing. You know, there are a lot of barriers that all women of color face, and I want to talk about what are some of the coping strategies that we use, and you kind of asked this question too. For African American women, I want to say that one of the things that happen is that we really rest on our faith. We don't always have a direct path on how we can do things. We don't necessarily have the money to get there. We don't necessarily always have even the education that we need, but we have faith that we can do it, and we rest on that faith. Very often African American people are very spiritual people. They rely on their prayers also to help them to accomplish the things that they need to accomplish. And they also draw strength from those who have come before them. So they pay attention to their parents' journey, to their grandparents' journey, to the stories of their great-grandparents, and those who have been successful and managed to survive in this country through our history. And they also work really hard, or we, not they, but we work really hard to sustain our own positive self-image. Another external coping strategy is that we lean on the shoulders of those that are around us. My God, Margaret, it's one of my very dear friends. And sometimes we spend time in really deep conversations where we cry together, we laugh together, we share our insights and reflect together. And that's been a really important coping strategy for survival. And a third coping strategy is that sometimes we have to alter our external behavior or our outward behaviors and presentation. Sometimes we have to avoid contact with certain people or situations that causes stress. And sometimes we just have to stand on our two feet and fight back. And we do that regularly. And lastly, we have to directly challenge the source of the problems that are there. And that's actually what the Anti-Racism Initiative is all about. Are there any other questions?
Comments?
Yes, Jay.
I know we only have like 2 minutes left, but and Sharon, you spoke to this, I think, really well when you said it is not the job of people of color to teach white people what's going on and how they should be doing this. But do you have advice for us as an audience to be more support, to figure out important ways of support based on the bias motivated events?
I can say that I know I teach racial issues classes, which probably all of you have taken since they're required classes, that it's very discouraging for people of color to see the news, to see articles, to see articles by, I guess, white students in the editorial column of our school newspaper, to see letters to the editor that say, hey, just, you know, don't take it seriously. It's just a joke. You know, I mean, you're making too much of a big deal about it. You know, to Jewish people whose grandparents could have been killed in concentration camps, to people who have been attacked and survived, and to the survivors of all kinds of discrimination, racism, it isn't a joke at all. So, I mean, just the basic level of respect is to, instead of just writing flippantly, well, it's not that big of a deal, well, why don't you, you know, really try to find out why it has a really emotional impact on many students here on our campus.
I just want to say, too, that I think that the responsibility to really understand what whiteness is all about is a responsibility of white people. You know, often I get asked to come and talk to groups of white people about whiteness and about privilege, and I keep thinking, why do they keep asking me to tell them what it means to be white? Surely they understand the advantages that are there, the access that they have that everybody doesn't have, and they can figure this out on their own. There is a responsibility for white people to begin to have those discussions together and to talk about how do we form a new consciousness around what whiteness is. And I would hope, and I challenge all of you to begin to have that conversation and think about that. Do some reflections on that. Thank you.